From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Another look back at 2016, this time with Crosstalk host Peter Laveau. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Monday.
I have to wonder if this year is going to be anything like the year that passed.
What a wild year we had. And I was looking to do a wrap-up piece with you, last week, because I was looking forward to what we were going to cover this week, and all of a sudden the big news between the U.S. and Russia happened in the last few days.
Yeah, you have to really wonder and step back. Is it really about Russia? Maybe. I rather flippantly on Facebook said before the expulsion of the Russian diplomats and Putin's non-reaction, essentially, is Barack Obama trying to create a legacy of an 8-year presidency after Donald Trump was elected president? Because, you know, during the campaign, Trump used to throw jabs at Jeb Bush that he was low energy. Well, I thought Obama was pretty much low energy for 8 years, except for the last few days. So it's really quite remarkable. There's so many different caveats to what's going on right now. Russia is, I'm not convinced it's really at the center of it. I think it's just to sabotage Trump as he goes into the Oval Office.
You know, on that point, I've heard from so many of my friends on the left, including really literally some of my close friends, that Obama's presidency was doomed, sabotaged, whatever, back in 2009, I think it was, with the election of that Republican senator in Massachusetts, which meant that the Democrats no longer had, although they had both houses at that time, they no longer had a Senate that was free of the possibility of being stymied by what do they call it in the Senate when they prattle on endlessly?
Like a filibuster.
A filibuster-proof Senate, right. And that because they didn't have a filibuster-proof Senate, and these are people that have been following this stuff for decades and whose opinion I generally respect, that he was so hamstrung by a lack of a filibuster-proof Senate that, in essence, whatever people hoped for and whatever he really intended wouldn't be actualized, and that was the excuse for the last 8 years. And suddenly, he's about ready to start World War III, basically, all by himself.
Well, it is an excuse. It is an excuse. Barack Obama didn't act like an efficient, engaged politician. It's called bipartisanship. It has a great tradition in our country, a great tradition. When the country needs our political elite to come together, it has in the past. But Barack Obama relied upon executive orders. That's how he ran his presidency. And now the chickens are coming home to roost, because he has no legacy that he left in a sense where he got the country politically to move together. He didn't do that for 8 years. And he's doing this executive order bit with a vengeance. Just making it very, very difficult for the next administration, irrespective of how you feel about Trump. That's what the electorate voted for. That's how our system works, okay? And it's called common courtesy to give the next person in line a fair passage to move forward for the country. What Barack Obama is doing right now, he appears to be some petulant child. I mean, I find it extraordinary. Let's look at the vote in the United Nations. Well, after 8 years in office, he decides to take a bold move on the Israeli-Palestine conflict? I mean, why didn't he do that the first week of his presidency? Maybe we have a very different Middle East now.
Well,
and in terms of just going after Russia, these sanctions are meaningless. Meaningless.
Right.
It is just PR. It's showing that he's some kind of standing on some kind of high moral position, which he is not whatsoever, when we know the incoming president has made it very clear that he wants to take a different track with Russia. What Barack Obama is doing right now is just silly politics. And I'll tell you, he looks very silly all around the world. I'm getting questions left and right all the time. Why is he doing this now? And I say, right. I really don't have a good answer for you because I don't understand the logic.
Right. Yeah, it only makes sense to me in the context of the, I posted this, you know, I don't know this is what's going to happen, and I figure this probably isn't what's going to happen, but these are the kind of things that happen right before war. And you know, the thing that gets me, first going back to what happened at the UN last week with respect to Palestine, you know, the bold move, quote unquote, in its essence, is that they abstained from voting on an otherwise unanimously adopted resolution condemning Israel for something that has been illegal for decades and that Israel has been continuing to do, which is an obvious affront to international law across the board under the UN Charter, building settlements on other people's land.
Yeah.
You know, that's the bold move. And, you know, he closes his presidency with that after opening it, watching the slaughter of thousands of people in Gaza and not even opining as an American citizen in January of 2009, saying there's only one president at a time. But now, on his way out, he's attempting to hamstring Donald Trump, who, regardless of what his intentions actually are or were at the time he said it, got elected saying, let's reverse our course of hostilities with Russia and make friends and work constructively together on things like dealing with terrorism. And what's happening is, it looks, like I said, these are the things that happened before an actual war, but it certainly looks like he's trying to politically foreclose the possibility of that for Trump.
Yes, and you know, the good thing in all of this is that the Russian side, Vladimir Putin, refused to parlay because this is just such nonsense coming out of Washington in the waning days of the Obama administration. Yeah. He didn't, you know, if you look at the rules of diplomacy, you know, it's called tit for tat. And if one country throws out diplomats, then the other country is going to respond. We've seen that. You and I have seen this over and over again. OK, and it really isn't a big deal. But I'm sure that the American administration, I'm sure Barack Obama's intelligence apparatus knows throwing Russians out on New Year's, right before New Year's, is really an insult because New Year's is the most important holiday for Russians. It's like Christmas and Thanksgiving and 4th of July all rolled up into one. And so that's really insulting. And it was for the families. You know, they even threw out the chef.
I know. And you know, the timing of it, the whole thing was, it was the most childish and cruel, really, at a human relations level. When you're talking about forcing people, declaring on Thursday, you have 72 hours to get out, you and your families, your chef, whatever else, get all the transcripts from your kids' schools, all that stuff. And then you have to travel, last minute notice, all 35 of your families on the busiest weekend both here and there, the last weekend of the holidays here, the first weekend of the holidays there. And for a while they were saying that you have to use commercial airlines, book a plane.
The Russian side did send a plane to pick them up.
And they finally let it land because they had been saying, first the Russians offered to do that, and then Washington was like, no, take commercial flights. And then they finally relented in the face of, you know, global public opinion, I think.
You know, one of the other things that are happening at the same time is that we had John McCain and Lindsey Graham in Kiev receiving honors from Poroshenko, the president there. And this is also at a time where the Ukrainians are celebrating, if I use that word very ironically, the legacy of Stepan Bandera, a Nazi collaborator, Nazi collaborator during the Second World War, who killed Jews, Poles, Russians, with great glee. And there was a torch lit parade for him. This is a time when American senators are in Kiev. And we have Barack Obama saying what he's saying about hacking. Don, correct me if I'm wrong, but right after the election, he came out and said there was no evidence any kind of cyber tampering with the American election. And then he changes his tune.
Although no evidence has been presented still. And in fact, what they present as evidence contains no evidence and not even a charge of that within it.
So one has to really wonder if this is just spitefulness. We both know this campaign was the most contentious one of our lifetime. Okay, obviously.
Sure.
Yep. We saw things and heard things and the way it was reported. I mean, it's this is something that, you know, you're going to tell your great-grandchildren one day. I mean, I remember the 2016 campaign. But there's got to be a point where we have to move on. I understand the Clinton people and their supporters are very disappointed. Why? Because the media tricked you into believing she was going to be the winner. Now, everybody needs to take a cold shower and get back to the business of running the country.
Right.
And Barack Obama renting a palatial apartment house within the confines of the Washington, D.C. area really kind of bugs me. I mean, he's the only asset the Democrats have right now. He is personally popular as a person. I don't deny him that. But that's the only thing they have left in the toolbox right now. They need some introspection. The Republicans did it in 2012 in a big way. And they had to decide how to move forward. The Democrats refused to get there. I mean, this is like dealing with, it's like child psychology. You make a mistake, you have to learn from your mistake. I don't have, I had malice towards Hillary Clinton because of her very corrupt political career, but I don't against other Democrats, okay? I don't. It's time to pick themselves up. We have to work with the new president, and we have to avoid conflicts in the future. I mean, you and I can go back and forth about his cabinet picks, which I'm personally not particularly happy with. But if he says no more forced regime change around the world, exporting of democracy, and we don't need to pick a fight with the Russians, you know, I can live with that. That's okay with me. That's a beginning of something there. But Barack Obama and his team seem to intentionally want to make sure that everything, every hope that Trump has in his worldview, and it's a very complicated, even contradictory worldview, we have to at least, you know, give the new president and his team a chance. And it does. It seems to me also, Don, I've never seen this in my lifetime again. It doesn't look like Barack Obama wants to go away.
I know. He's reminding me of Rudy Giuliani in the days after September 11th, when his term was supposed to be up. And he was talking about, well, he was doing an Alexander Haig, basically. I got everything under control over here. Don't worry about it. He didn't want to go away either.
You know, one has to really wonder how... I mentioned the two senators, McCain and Lindsey Graham and Kibbe. I find this is really disturbing here, because we see the outgoing administration aligning themselves with a very strong anti-Russia position coming from the GOP. Well, Donald Trump is technically the head of the GOP right now. And I keep cautioning people. I remember doing a crosstalk 15 minutes after the election was called. And we were the first program in English to actually do something, an entire thing, not just reporting the news, but a program on it.
Right.
And one of the first things came to mind is that, you know, are the Republicans going to work with Donald Trump? And I think this is really the main issue that we have to address, because particularly on foreign policy, you know, we see Trump waffling on the Iran deal that was made, which I am a supporter of, because we don't need to have a conflict with Iran.
Right.
Iran can be a positive ally in the region if people would just cool their heads down and look at things objectively. I mean, you can't isolate Iran. You can't isolate Russia. This is foolishness. You need to engage these countries. And I think the U.S. should disengage countries like Saudi Arabia, and it should really give a very stern lecture against Israel and tell it to start getting serious, because I'm so sick and tired of everything that's been done since the Oslo Agreement, where it means no peace for the Palestinians. I'm glad that went to the vote, because I want people to remember in America, learn a little bit more about that conflict, and we'll see how Donald Trump maneuvers through that. We both know how powerful the Israeli lobby is in the United States.
Yeah. You know, on the point of the Republicans woodshedding back in 2012 after their defeat, you know, for president, they, by the way, maintained control of Congress through that. But they lost the presidency for the second time running, and there was this soul searching that was done publicly, et cetera. But I don't think necessarily their capture of the White House was a product of that, but rather that it happened in spite of it, because the Republican establishment churned out, you know, we had Cruz and the whole lot of those people, including Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. who are conventional Republican politicians, and then looking at the possible changes in foreign policy, and I would say domestic policy too, by the way, looking at what Trump intends to do in terms of investment, that the Republican establishment and the establishment generally is still aligned against that. If you look at the media, during the campaign, Fox was the only one that wouldn't run with the anti-Trump narrative of the day. They would defend Trump that way while saying, however, but he has no chance of winning. He's down 30 points in the
poll. Fox is really interesting because, it wasn't clear cut even at Fox. There were a lot of dissenting voices.
Right.
There were a lot of people that did this kind of passive aggressive attitude towards Trump. And then there were Tucker Carlson, and then you have
Garrett Nixon,
people like that. They stuck with the very much of a conservative line. But you're absolutely right. I mean, Trump won the presidency under the Republican Party in spite of the Republicans.
Right.
It's really amazing.
I mean, you had those same people, McCain and Graham and stuff, at different points in time, essentially campaigning for Clinton, even when they didn't overtly state it. They were condemning Trump for this, almost everything that came out of his mouth. And now Fox is taking the position, on the one hand, MSNBC and CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, complete anti-Russia. It's like Boris Badenov has taken over the KGB, which really hasn't even changed its name. And there's spies' nests everywhere, that whole bit. Fox is saying that even while they're saying, let Trump have a chance to reset relations. And by the way, we can always go to war with China. So the whole establishment is still, he's going to have quite a fight on his hands.
I'm very pessimistic when I look at all these things, but then I have to, open the window and let some cool air in, because in Moscow, all the buildings are so warm inside during winter. But he did win the presidency.
That's right.
He did. Yep. Against all the odds. Against the media was against him. His own party was against him. It's extraordinary. It's still a political earthquake that when I wake up in the morning, I said, he actually still won. This is, weeks and weeks later, and I'm still shocked by it. Look, he won the presidency. So I guess I have to believe in miracles or something like that.
Right.
Not that I am a strident supporter of Trump. No, I'm not. Okay. I'm very critical of many, many things that he says, many things. But I believe in staying with our tradition is that when you pass the torch, a lot of Americans don't even know that it was in 1800. We went from Jefferson to Adams, two people that hated each other, really, really
That's
hated
right.
each other in
yep.
public.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
But both of them respected each other. And that's the beginning of a wonderful, great tradition. And we need to remind ourselves that that's the kind of tradition that we have to honor, because that's what help makes it work. I mean, we have enough troubles as it is. OK, we don't need to go into another presidency where it's just absolutely a brick wall gridlock where they're not going to allow him to get anything done. And I'll tell you, Don, this is going to make Trump more popular. It will.
I think so, too. That's what we saw happen.
People are going to say it's rigged against him. He was right. I like that term, because the media rigged it against him.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Members of the Republican Party rigged it against him.
Yep.
And the fury of so many people, the American public isn't even aware that 50% of the country is poor. It's just poor.
Mm-hmm.
And, if people don't get outside their comfort zones, and they won't see it, and these politicians just fly over everything. That's why Donald Trump won. He won in spite of all these things. It's not that I think he's the messiah for so many people. It's that everything else around them they see is rotten. It's gotten rotten to the core. And I think this is the explanation for his victory. It's not him in of himself, really.
Right,
it is a phenomenon.
That's right.
And Trump is going to have to not rely on the Republican Party. He's going to have to build a movement.
He will get
disaffected Democrats. He did. People that voted for Barack Obama twice voted for him.
That's right. So or didn't vote.
Yep. This is what he has to be thinking in terms of, is building a movement. And if he can do that, that will create enough social pressure on the media, because I think more and more people just I can, because of my job, I have to watch MSNBC and CNN. Right. But it really is disturbing as I watch it. You know, the Washington Post reporting that what was it, the Vermont electricity grid was hacked by the Russians. And I read that and said, what are you guys talking about?
And then you look at the evidentiary basis, and what you find out is there's some laptop that wasn't connected to the grid, by the way, that had some outdated Ukrainian malware that people used to try to rip off each other's bank accounts and stuff and their Facebook pages. And that showed basically that the Russian government was trying to infiltrate the U.S. electrical grid. That's the evidentiary basis for the Washington Post, one of the papers of record.
You know, also the Guardian, Luke Harding, he is the hee-haw character of Russia reporting in the UK. This guy is really pathetic. Putin offered the children of American diplomats to come and spend their New Year's party at the Kremlin.
Right.
And Luke Harding, he can always come up with something. Oh, that is a veiled threat from Putin that he has his eye on children. It's in The Guardian. Oh, my goodness.
I know. I mean, that passes for news. You know, go back to the point about, what happened with the election and the way that public opinion not only ignored but actually reacted in opposition to the constant feed from the media. You know, if you look at the way that this narrative that exists in the U.S. media is constructed, it's, you know, these talking points, you can treat them almost like information fractals, because they've got this fantasy narrative that has to confront ever-changing circumstances on the ground almost on a daily basis. Like last week with and the resolution that was adopted at the UN, not the one with Palestine, but the one with respect to a ceasefire agreement in Syria. Right. You know, a Russian-Turkey initiative. That, in geopolitical terms, is itself almost a geological event, okay, that Russia and Turkey, and it's holding. And so you have this dynamic where they float these talking points that have a life of their own. They come out of people's mouths on it. I heard them at a New Year's party coming out of some otherwise very intelligent and astute people. These things that sort of fit together and are dynamic in relation to each other, so that that narrative doesn't collapse unless you look for evidence supporting it, no matter what happens tomorrow. You could have the second coming of Jesus, World War III, a plague, universal peace, and whatever happens, this narrative can still continue on its own because it has nothing to do with reality. And people finally voted in opposition to it.
Yeah, it's really interesting, is because if you look at all of the polling during the election, there's one conclusion to draw, and it's the most obvious, simple one, is that people lied to the pollsters because they don't believe the pollsters. They see the pollsters as part of the establishment. They see the questions are leading. When I worked for Colgate-Palmolive, when I lived in Poland many, many years ago, I used to write up questionnaires. I know how to write up a questionnaire,
right,
and I can get you answers you want, okay? Right. I can, all right? Mm-hmm. And this is what the pollsters do, because these pollsters have the same political affinity of people in American newsrooms.
Well, they're hired. So, most of them are. They're products of those news organizations. The CBS, New York Times poll, you know, Washington Post poll, you know, USA Today, Gannett poll, etc.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we both would agree that the narrative about the 2016 presidential election is glaring, and it is almost in a category of its own. But the whole story about Aleppo is even a dimension, even a level higher than that. And this is one of the reasons why you're not getting a whole lot of coverage of that United Nations Security Council resolution, because it doesn't compute. And if it doesn't compute, throw it out.
That's
okay.
Right.
Just don't mention it.
Yeah, that's part of how the fractals stand also, is you just don't report or emphasize the things that are in direct contradiction to the narrative.
When I looked, you know, it was extraordinary going to work and in my office having monitors of Al Jazeera on my wall, CNN and RT, Press TV, and you could just see two different universes, parallel universes. It was really extraordinary. Yeah. Just take your chair and just sit in front of the monitors and just see how a story, two different, radically different narratives are in play. And when you look at, you know, RT and Press TV, two news outlets of limited resources compared to everybody else. And we did a fantastic job. I mean, yeah. I think it's some of the best reporting in television of our time. Yeah. And it was gutsy. We had people on the ground that can speak the language, okay, yeah. knows the culture, and got it and showed us pictures of things that no one else was seeing. And CNN saying these are the first pictures of a Western reporter. No, well, we have a British woman working for us, and she was 2 days ahead of CNN yeah. in Aleppo. Yeah. But no, they never mentioned
it. Oh, Lizzie Phelan's been on the ground
yeah,
in Syria.
She's amazing. Yeah, she's an amazing journalist, and she's an amazing person to
and
know.
She just turned 30. She's a kid. She just, you know, I mean, she's an adult, certainly, she's young.
She's so gutsy.
And she was on the ground in Libya when it was being bombed, and yeah. closing days, and was she 25 years old, 24 years old then?
No, I met on our 10th anniversary party the year before last. I finally had the pleasure of meeting her, and I just yeah. she's a very small framed person, you know. And
I've
think,
met her
wow
too.
You've done stuff that, you know, veteran journalists, you know, it takes them two or three decades to accomplish what you've been able to do in a few short years.
And not only that, my deepest source in for Latin America and Caribbean news, Stephen Sefton, that uses the name Tony Solo here on CPR. I met him through Lizzie. Okay, and I've been doing, you know, I've been interested in politics since the 1960s, and she has like all these people all over the world already that she's working with as colleagues. She's an amazing person. Now, you know, I want to get to this point before we close, which is that if you look at, you know, you were talking about half the country is poor and it's not reported. And even if the individual members of the half the country that are poor don't know that half the country is poor, they sure as hell know that they're poor. And they know essentially what happened that got them there. And that's how they voted. And that the fact that the people that voted Trump into office and voted Clinton out, however you want to, you know, portray it, they did so based on their economic condition. And that is so true that they finally have had to actually show it in their polls. But the earlier polls, like in August after the conventions, when they were announcing that Trump was tanking, and here's the polling evidence. When I actually looked at the studies, you know, the actual polling, 33-page, you know, presentation, I looked for worker, job, employee, you know, search terms through these things, and they didn't appear in it.
Yeah. you know why? Because, and again, we may find differences between ourselves on this, but it's because the whole culture wars meme has exhausted itself.
That's right.
It has exhausted itself.
I agree with that.
Because just as you just said, 100% spot on, people look at their own conditions.
That's right.
Okay. And we live in, or at least in America, it is a consumer-driven society. It's about getting stuff, okay? Mm-hmm. And if you can't get stuff,
That's right.
You don't even find any more human dignity in what you do, mm-hmm. because you can't live the way you want to live, or way, quote unquote, the way you're supposed to live. And I think the whole cultural wars phenomenon has masked that for way too long, and people are just saying, look, I can't take a third mortgage out of my house. I can't help my kids through school. As a matter of fact, my college kids are moving back in with us. Okay, this is pushing people to the wall.
That's right.
And this is why people voted. I mean, the most ironic thing, of course, is they voted for a billionaire, which is
right.
amazing, okay?
Yep.
But I think, you know, you're absolutely right, is that I'm not going to dismiss you know, how people define their identity. I think that's fine. But, you know, don't do it at the expense of people's socioeconomic conditions. OK,
right.
And that's essentially what they want you to do.
That's right.
And there's a limit to it. They push it to the limit. It snapped. The tension was too great after too many decades of talking about the wrong things, at least putting the wrong things first. It's nothing wrong talking about these other things on the periphery in my mind, okay? But don't make it front and center, because most people don't live that way. They live in the here and now and that paycheck at the end of the week, full stop.
That's right. And that's true. Whether they're white working class in Ohio, Muslims, people that are in same-sex marriages, whatever, everyone needs a job and some dignity. Peter, it's a pleasure speaking with you, and I look forward to doing it again many times over the course of this coming year. And again, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and see you on Crosstalk. Bye, Don.
Goodbye, Peter. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.